and welcome to OSC's Conversations. I'm Sandy Pastor. I'm the Executive Director of Oswego Senior Center. And today I'm here with Dan Sullivan, who is the Director of Spiritual Care over at Rush Copley Medical Center, and Kathy McPherson, who is a Hospice Care Consultant with Seasons Hospice. And today we are here to talk about resources and coping and support for coping and support as part of the Rush Copley Chronic Disease series that we're doing. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Dan, can you tell us a little bit about what you do over at Rush?
I'm the Director of Spiritual Care there. So I help provide direct care and supervise our program for providing spiritual and emotional support for patients and families and staff members.
Okay. And what do you do over at Seasons?
Basically, in the role of Hospice Care Consultant, at Rush Copley, I cover the entire hospital, which means I work with all the different departments. I spend a lot of time meeting with patients and families, discussing both palliative care and hospice opportunities, basically explaining what it is, what it is not. We do a lot of education with the physicians on how to identify, we call them triggers or prognostic indicators, as to how they can identify patients that are appropriate for hospice or palliative care. So there's a lot of mixture between the education of actually the staff and working with the patients and families themselves.
So we're talking about a time in the diagnosis of chronic disease where you're kind of looking at the end of life. And so you're thinking about having conversations with family and what that means. You're having conversations with your doctors. You're putting documents together, hopefully, that will help the process go as you want it to go. So let's talk a little bit about how do you start to have these conversations with the most important, your family and people that love you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, conversation and communication is probably a somewhat challenged art. I think a lot of times we just don't communicate or we miscommunicate. I always tease that, using an illustration from my household, my wife has tinnitus or ringing in the ears. I'm also starting to lose the upper tones in my hearing, which correspond with the female vocal range. So once in a while, the conversation or the misconversation in my house goes like this. What? Did you say something? Oh, you're mumbling again. Oh, no, I'm not. And we can tease about it, but it's a miss. It's a misfire. It's a miscommunication. Sometimes I think we just, maybe don't talk about things. And so some conversations are missed. There's missed opportunities. And, it goes into simple things. And then the more significant things where maybe there are some additional challenges. So maybe, I can't tell you how many times in my career I've had a patient tell me, this is what I'm feeling or what I'm thinking about, but I really wouldn't want to tell my kids. I'd upset them, or I'd have the adult children say, oh, yeah, I know this is going on with mom or dad, their disease process, and things are getting worse. They're getting admitted more and more now than they used to be, but I really don't want to bring it up. And so there's these missed opportunities. And so sometimes conversations don't take place. And it's like a lawyer told me one time about wills, it's too early to talk about them until it's too late. So sometimes that's what happens is we don't have conversations. And as you mentioned, Sandy, with our loved ones or our physician, which are really key. And, has anything changed in your health over the last year? Since your last doctor visit or your last deep discussion with your loved ones, do you have different views? Have you shared it? That's really the starting point. So really the first step is really having a conversation with someone so that doesn't remain a mystery, because sometimes that can come back to really add a significant burden to family and the patient themselves later on when maybe health continues to change.
I know. I always think about my mother-in-law, who is always like, I don't want anything done. If something happens, that's it. And I said, well, you better write it down because if you don't have it written down, then that's not what's going to happen. They're going to do everything they can to help you live.
So the first step really is having those conversations. And it really is anywhere along the health spectrum. Sometimes when we talk about advanced directives, we just think of end of life. It's not just about end of life. So advanced directives are written communication tools that either help us appoint a medical decision maker who can speak for ourselves down the road if we can't, or they express our wishes about future healthcare at a time maybe we wouldn't be able to express them. So in Illinois, there are four types. One's called the power of attorney for healthcare. Another one is the living will. Third is the declaration of mental health treatment. And the fourth is the practitioner orders for life-sustaining treatment form, or POLST is the acronym.
And that took the place of the DNR that a lot of people are familiar with.
Mostly, yes. Yeah. It helps resuscitation wishes become portable. But each of these documents have a different purpose, and they work differently, and they really come in at a different point during one's life. So you think of the kind of the spectrum from when we're born to when we pass away. Early on, when there are relatively few medical complications, people would still benefit by considering doing the written document called the Power of Attorney for Healthcare. Now, it's optional, as all these documents are, but it helps us name a decision maker. Why is that important? Because once in a while, something happens, the person is brought into a hospital where they're not known, they're being treated by a physician that they don't know. People maybe gather around my bed if I'm the patient, and the doctor turns to the group and says, what do you think Dan would want? And sometimes they don't have a clue because Dan never told them. Or maybe the person that speaks up is not the person that Dan would want to speak up for him.
Right.
All right. So in Illinois, if someone doesn't have a power of attorney for healthcare, and they're not able to speak for themselves, the physician invokes something called the Surrogate Act, and then he appoints or she appoints someone to make decisions for me. And the go-to person would be, you know, top of the priority list. If I already had, if I were married or in a civil union, that would be the go-to person. Then do I have adult children? It would go on down the line to maybe even a close friend. You know, that may or may not be the person that I'd want to have speak for me.
Right.
You know, so the easiest thing is to do a power of attorney for healthcare document. I can name someone that can speak for me. If I can't, I can name a backup person or a secondary. And then I want to make those wishes be known. So I want to take that document. Next time I see my physician, bring it in, give him or her a copy. Next time I come to the hospital, bring in a copy so we can have it in the medical record. Why? Because it helps the medical community serve my needs, my wishes, not somebody else's. So
right.
The reality is that it's a great tool. And it can be done, really. Anybody over 18 ought to consider doing one of those.
And they're free to do.
Absolutely. And then further down the line, maybe I'm starting to have a few more health issues. Maybe I'm starting to be hospitalized more frequently. Maybe I have a chronic disease, like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, or congestive heart failure, diabetes, whatever. Maybe things are progressing a little bit. Maybe my size up starts changing a little bit about what I would want or not want if I were approaching the end.
Mm-hmm.
I may want to consider doing a living will. You know, a living will has been around since about 1969. It just expresses my wishes. It says, you know, to you, my physician, to you, my family, these are my wishes if I can't express them for myself. If these two conditions are met, I'm asking for palliative care. I would want to be a DNR. I'd want just comfort care. If I'm in a situation where I'm irreversibly ill and I'm truly at death's door. Now, both those conditions have to be there, but that's a document and speak for me when I can't. All right. So that's one. There's something called a declaration of mental health treatment. That's kind of like a specialized power of attorney for healthcare that I could say this person, it could make this person my spokesperson or my agent to speak for me about mental health admissions, and maybe request a certain psychiatrist to be part of my care plan because that's my normal physician. That's very highly specialized, but
right.
That's a document. And then there's this document called POLST that you alluded mm-hmm. to, you know, where in the hospital, it's very easy for the physician and the staff to understand what people's wishes are about end of life or to carry those things out. If I say, the presumption is always we'll do everything we can to try to rescue somebody who appears to be dying, or if they pass away, to actually try to bring them back with CPR.
Right.
In the event, you know, someone says, I really don't want that, you know, do what you can to help me. But, you know, if my heart stops, my breathing stops, just let it be. The doctor can write an order, the mid-level can write an order that's communicated to the staff, and we respect that person's wishes by not doing a code if they pass away. They may have wishes not to have certain things done in advance of that, like not to have a breathing tube placed or be on the ventilator for someone that would want a DNR to be in place if they pass. That gets expressed relatively easily. Problem is, however, if I go home as a patient, the physician orders don't carry with me.
Right.
And so that's where the pulse document came about, to help make my resuscitation wishes be portable. And so that's binding then on EMS and hospital folks and nursing home folks and other healthcare providers.
So you can keep that pulse document like along with your medications, because I know when if you are, you know, getting emergency treatment, the medics will pretty much go to find your medications. So if you have those documents there, then
if it's in a place that we can mm-hmm. find it, I could say I was a medic for about 28 years.
Yeah.
And I could say, you know, our first priority is always to go in and assess the patient. But say if they had a vial of life in their refrigerator, or they had a sleeve on the door that had their documents, and we see that, then that could help direct our care.
Right.
You know, people can complete any of these advanced directives, and if they just put them in a lockbox and don't tell their kids and don't tell their physicians about it, they don't do anybody any good. But
right.
it's a communication tool that now that's just a very specialized one. That with you know the pulse document really should only be done for someone that thinks that it's possible that they might pass in the next year. It's not the document that everyone would have, you know. But it's just a tool that's available. You know, these are all just written tools.
Right. And so how do you start those conversations with your family to say, hey, you know, I'm doing my power of attorney for healthcare and I'd really like you to be my agent, or I don't want your other sister to be my agent. Right. You know, how do you?
It can be difficult and it depends on the family dynamic a little bit. I know I wanted to talk to my oldest son about being the secondary on my document. Oh, Dad, I don't want to talk about that right now. Well, no, I need to talk about that right now. You
right.
know, so part of it is how trying to get someone's attention, saying this is just an eventuality. I just want you in the loop. Okay. I might revise that down the road. It can be difficult. You know, you can choose the way the document goes in Illinois, you can only put one person on the blank. So I can only
right.
appoint, say I could only appoint you, Sandy, as my decision maker. Right?
And that helps prevent
and maybe
fighting.
You and Kathy are our sisters.
Yeah.
And then, well, which one do I choose? And why is the other one left out and everything? It's
right.
like, well, that can be kind of snarky to navigate. You know, do I choose the sister that's closest in town to me that would be respond to the hospital? Do I choose the sister that's most aligned with my thinking?
Which is
a key thing, right?
Yeah, because when it comes to palliative care or hospice, and you're having that conversation, there have been many times where a patient has been chosen somebody to be their power of attorney for healthcare and did not share what their wishes were. And thus the POA said, I'm not going to do that. And I'm like, well, yes, you are, because it says here. So it's so important that they understand what the patient's wishes are and they're willing to honor those wishes. Because if, for example, I was telling my husband, if something happens to me, I don't want this and this. And he said, I can't do that. So thus I did not choose my husband as my power of attorney, which is, you know, he loves me that much that he wants to keep me going no matter what. But
yeah.
those are not my personal wishes. So it depends on if that person is actually okay with how you feel and they're willing to step up and say, yes, I'm honoring his wishes and this is what he wants and we're not going to do this. So it's really it's a very interesting subject because a lot of people name POAs and don't talk to them about what their wishes are. And then you get in a real sticky situation.
And some people are
right.
named POAs that don't know they've been named.
Yes.
We had a situation, I recall, when a gentleman, a good friend of his, named him as the power of attorney for healthcare. He didn't know he was being named. The gentleman was in serious condition, and the physician talked to the POA agent and said, well, what would you do here? And he goes, well, why are you talking to me? Well, you've been named. And he was frozen with panic and finally said, I just can't. Joe never talked to me about this. I don't know what he would do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to make this life and death situation decision. And so he didn't. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the document empowers someone to be the decision maker. It doesn't make them decide. But it would be good for me to say, you know, Kathy, would you be willing to be my agent and
right.
have that conversation? And these are my thoughts, at least right now, where I'm at in my life and in my journey, instead of just, you know, scrawling the name on the paper and then
right.
the conversation.
And then as those wishes change, should health conditions change and quality of life change and things like that, then reflect those on the document.
Absolutely. And just like a will, you know, a new document supersedes an old one, you know, so if my wishes change, I can do a new document. If I no longer care for the person I named as the agent, I want to change that up, I can change that up. And, you know,
or if they pass away.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which is why it's a good idea to probably have that secondary.
Right. So we have the conversation with our family. We have all of our documents in place. We're on a path of chronic disease that is unfortunately towards the end, and we're looking at hospice. And now we have these options with hospice. It's called palliative care or hospice care. And it's very confusing, even for people like me that have been in the business for a long time. So can you tell us what is the difference between palliative care and hospice care?
I absolutely can. And I'm going to do this in such a way that it helps you relate it to something else, and which makes it a little bit easier to understand. Palliative care is an area of specialty, just like an oncologist or a cardiologist would choose that area of specialty as a physician. Physicians choose palliative medicine as a specialty, okay? So when a person is in a disease process and they're still pursuing curative measures, they're not 6 months or less prognosis, then they may choose to see a palliative physician or a palliative nurse practitioner to help manage their symptoms. So basically what it is another specialty consult. It's billed under, just like an oncologist would bill under Medicare Part B, a palliative physician or nurse practitioner would bill under Medicare Part B.
Okay.
It's just one more team member in your group of physicians that are helping to manage your care. And their area of specialty is not just pain management, but any kind of symptom. It can be constipation, nausea, excessive vomiting, pain, agitation. So while a person is pursuing, for example, a cancer patient, they are going through chemo still or still receiving radiation treatments. And they still want to go back to the hospital if needed. And maybe they have home care in place. You can actually then add a palliative team member that can come and see the patient in the home. They can come to one of the, Rush Copley has a advanced illness clinic that's available to them. But they add in one more team member into their area of health care. So that's the easiest way to think about it.
Okay.
Is a specialty visit.
A specialty visit mm-hmm. that helps you better manage
your
symptoms yeah. that are...
Mm-hmm. So like if, mm-hmm. also if you're going to a facility such as, you know, the Tillers or, you know, one of the ones in the area for skilled days and you're doing some sort of rehab, in order to keep doing that rehab, if you're having a lot of pain, you might want to have a palliative team member, physician or nurse practitioner come in, do the assessment. And they do a complete head to toe assessment. They communicate with the primary care physician. It's, you know, again, a very communicative part of the healthcare where everybody's to all the physicians are talking to each other, but very important to manage those symptoms so the patient can continue doing physical therapy. Because if they're in terrible pain and they can't do it, that's going to hinder their skilled days. So to have the palliative team member involved at that point is good too. Also, a lot of the cancer centers now are actually having conversations with patients about palliative care early on in their diagnosis. Because it's important to know, most people want to know everything that's out there. They want to know everything that they can tap into, as much health support as they can get, so they have, you know, comfort and quality of life, mm-hmm. even when they're still pursuing the curative measures. So a lot of the social workers and cancer centers are just having an initial conversation with the patient about what palliative care is, and it's there if they choose to participate in it or not.
Okay. So then what's hospice?
Okay. So hospice then is when a patient is at a point where they are no longer going to pursue curative measures. They are not interested in any more chemotherapy or radiation, COPD patients, congestive heart failure patients. A lot of them are frequent flyers that are coming into the hospital over and over again
right.
to have their symptoms managed. And they get to the point that they're like, you know what, enough. I just want to be comfortable. Now, it's just a service, which means you're not stuck on it. In order to qualify to come on to hospice, two physicians have to agree that your prognosis is 6 months or less. So that would be the initial physician at Copley, either hospitalist or primary care physician or specialist writing that order. And then the second physician is the hospice physician after a clinical assessment is done by an admissions nurse. So that's how you qualify to come on to hospice. It doesn't mean you can't leave your house. It doesn't mean that You know, people have so many misconceptions. All it means is that at this point in time, there isn't anything that they can do to aggressively treat to cure. So now we're in the mode of aggressively treating the symptoms to make sure that they're comfortable.
Right.
So I hope that, does that kind of give it a...
Yeah, so you're not harnessed to your house. You can still enjoy your as much quality of life as you have left.
Correct.
In an environment where you're hopefully not having to, you know, your life not having to be lessened or the quality through all the different treatments that are happening that maybe not
exactly
be working.
And the bad part of one of the biggest misconceptions is that when you come onto hospice, that means you're going to be passing within the next 5 days. And that is such a horrible misconception,
right?
Because two things are important to know. Number one, hospice is covered 100% under Medicare, Medicaid, and most insurances. Now, there are private insurances that have copays or deductibles that have to be met. But most importantly, Medicare and Medicaid cover this at 100%, which means it covers all the equipment the patient needs. It covers all of the medications that fall under their hospice diagnosis. So those medications are delivered to their home or wherever they're living. And it covers all of our services. So it's you gain this team of people that are coming to help you. And at the minimum, we want to see a nurse coming out to see this patient at minimum once or twice a week. But everything is predicated on how the patient's doing. So patient needs a nurse visit 2 times a week or 3 times a week. They can absolutely do that. We can talk about, there's 4 levels of care in hospice that we can talk about also. But it's important to know that this benefit, even though the prognosis, as I mentioned before, is agreed upon by 2 physicians at 6 months or less, it just keeps going on and on. So Medicare and Medicaid, the benefit never stops. So there's patients that are in hospice for 1 year or 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
We've definitely heard of that here. Or going off of hospice and going into palliative care.
They graduate from hospice, which means they're doing really well. So they sign off of hospice and then maybe come back down the line.
Right.
And also, you know, if you have, for example, a congestive heart failure diagnosis and you fall and hurt your wrist, you can still go to the hospital for that because it has nothing to do with your initial hospice diagnosis, which in that case would have been congestive heart failure. So it doesn't even restrict you from going to the hospital. It just means you're not going to go to the hospital for that specific, under that diagnosis of congestive heart failure. But if you fall and hurt yourself or something else is going on that's completely unrelated, you can still go to the hospital for that too. And even if you're on hospice and you change your mind and you want to go back to the hospital because something's going on, you can absolutely do that. It's just you have to tell them upon arrival at the ER that you're a hospice patient. They revoke you off immediately. You go right back to your regular benefits and get the treatments that you need. And then when you get back home, you get back on hospice again. So it's nothing that's restrictive. You can always come in out of it.
The patient's always empowered to make his or her decision
all
the way along the process.
And right.
I think one of the things we fight against all the time is the perception that you do aggressive care or you do nothing, which is terrible. Sometimes people think that with the DNR thing as well. It doesn't mean do not treat. It just means the goals of treatment have changed. Why? Because I want those goals to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that what's achievable has changed, but I make a decision about, you know, what I want and what I don't want. And so it really is about respecting my wishes.
Correct.
And curative care or palliative care or hospice care.
And also it gives the patient, when their symptoms are managed and they're comfortable, it gives the patient the ability to continue to do the things that they want to do. So for example, if you want to go to a restaurant out with your family, you can absolutely do that. You know, if you want to go visit somebody, and we have, we're in 22 states. So we can meet the patient at the other end when they say they want to go to Florida and visit family members and they're feeling up to it. They can absolutely do that. So again, a lot of times it's that misconception of people thinking that, you know, you're giving up hope and you're just in your house and it's the end. And it's sad because I would say in the 14 years I've been at Seasons, that's been the conversation I've had the most about people have all these preconceived notions about what hospice is. And once they realize all it is it's a specialty area where people are coming in to help out, and it takes the pressure off of the family because this is as much for the family as it is for the patient. They need support. They need to know that they can pick up the phone anytime, 24 hours a day, call hospice and get a nurse on the phone, and we can send a nurse out anytime, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So you have that support system where the wife can just be the wife and the kids can be the kids, and let us take some of that load off your shoulders.
That's great. So, you know, that's a difficult conversation to have, though, with families and family members. So how can families start to have that conversation with their children, for example?
Basically, what happens is I what was Chaplain mentioned before about how they want to talk to us, but they're afraid to have, you know, their kids hear it. So what we do is in the hospital situation, a lot of times that's where I encounter the patients, or if they're leaving the hospital, they want somebody to come to their home, but it's to have everybody present in the room. So everybody's hearing the same thing. Yeah. And what I do is I want to hear their story. I ask, when I sit down, tell me what's been going on. Tell me what brought you to the hospital this past time. And they start to talk about what's been going on. They're short of breath. They're having, you know, excessive, you know, vomiting and nausea. They're, you know, on opioids. So ended up with a bowel obstruction. I mean, it could be so many different things.
Right.
And what the art form of hospice is in palliative care is to come up with the combination of medications that works best for that particular patient. Everybody's different. Our body types are different. Our tolerance level to medication, our disease process is different. You know, you could have somebody that's been on Norco for 7 years for back pain and somebody else that's only been on Tylenol their whole life. We have to figure out how much to give that patient and of what drug. There's bone pain, nerve pain, muscle pain. So the palliative and hospice piece of it comes in and completely assesses that patient as to everything that's going on. And then we come up with the plan that works best for them. So it's not going up and down their symptom up, you know, pain, you know, there's long acting opioids, there's breakthrough pain. So I guess what I'm saying is when you go in and you talk to the families and the patient and they're hearing it all together and they know that after, if they just try this, because again, you can always sign off of it if you don't like it.
Right.
It gives them an opportunity to say, okay, this is going to help me have quality of life. This is going to help me spend time with my kids and my grandkids. This is going to help me go outside if I want to. Whereas now I can't do this because I'm suffering all the time or I can't sleep at night. So they're hearing that here's an option to try. And you're going to have at least, like I said, there's a whole team of people that we offer, but at the minimal, a nurse to come out and help catch things before they get too bad. For example, they're going to assess that patient a couple of times a week from head to toe. Are they sleeping okay? So maybe they're showing signs of a urinary tract infection. Well, then we start on antibiotics for that before it escalates. And a lot of these patients we call frequent flyers, which means they're in the ER over and over and over again.
Right.
And that's what I always ask the patient themselves. Do you want to come back to the hospital anymore? And I'm telling you, again, for 14 years, I could probably count on one hand how many patients have said, yes, I want to come back to the hospital. Most of them don't because it's too much for them. They're already in a disease process for having all these things going on. And now they're going to spend 4 or 5, 6 hours in the ER and then get admitted to a hospital. And it's just kind of a cycle. So right. That's the other thing I ask. How many times have you been in the hospital in the past 12 months? And, you know, a lot of times they kind of laugh or say, oh, my gosh, 12 times.
Yeah.
And so that helps avoid that. So, and that's where, again, we get into the different levels of care. So when you talk to the families and the patients, they're hearing that there's a plan of care that we're going to put in place. They're hearing that they're in complete control because no one from hospice is ever going to say, this is what you have to do. We offer options based on what's going on. To us, everything's an emergency in hospice. So when we're called and we get over there, okay, this is what's going on. We can offer you A, B, and C. What would you like to do? They're in control of this part of healthcare, which is what makes it very unique also. So.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of great options out there for people. They just need to know about it. They need to talk to their families. They need to look within themselves as well as to know what they want, what they really want to maintain a quality of life and what that looks like at different periods of their life. Mm-hmm. So any last thoughts that you'd like to wrap up with?
Well, people are never alone with whatever they're going through. And that's the take-home message. And we'd like to think that their family, whoever family is for them, accompanies them on this journey through life. And also when they're in the hospital, they have professionals that can help them. Certainly, they could always ask a chaplain to be paged at our place or at most other hospitals. There are some other resources as well. In conjunction with Seasons, we operate something called an advanced illness support clinic that you mentioned. And in that situation, anybody that you know, suffering from cancer or COPD or CHF or diabetes-related complications or dementia, those are people that we can help. And just as hospice provides some more tools, or in palliative care provides some more tools. The advanced illness clinic can do that as well. And so, a physician can make a referral to that clinic. They would come over to Copley as an outpatient, an advanced care practitioner, advanced practice nurse from Seasons, and kind of discuss their case. And it's just some more input on if there's anything else that can be done to help somebody now, whatever they're dealing with at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that's an opportunity that they could also call that number, which is 630-692-5962. Yes, that's the Advanced Illness Support Clinic at Rush Copley. And for those that are dealing with cancer, or for family members that are dealing with cancer, there's also the Waterford Place, which is at the junction of 34 and Waterford Drive. You don't have to be a patient that's seen at Copley, but if you're just some way impacted by cancer, there's wonderful resources from meditation and different therapy and groups and
cooking classes, plant-based cooking classes.
It is awesome.
Yeah. And it's a really beautiful facility.
And it's all donated. And so it doesn't cost anybody a dime. And that's just a wonderful resource. So again, if you're dealing with cancer right now in your life, or someone that you love is dealing with cancer, they can contact Waterford Place. And the contact number there is 331-301-5280. So that's Waterford Place. 331-301-5280.
And it's right over by the hospital there.
And if I can just talk a little bit about just what I had mentioned earlier, and there's four levels of care in hospice. Mm-hmm. First level of care is routine, and that's where patients doing really well. Meds are working like they're supposed to. Everybody's communicating and then pulling the rope in the same direction as relates to the care. And that's where the nurse sees the patient periodically between Monday through Friday, the case manager that's assigned. Like I mentioned before, with Seasons Hospice, you can have a nurse come anytime, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no matter where you're at. The next level of care up from that is called continuous care or crisis care. And that's where a patient is having a symptom where we don't feel comfortable leaving their bedside. So Medicare offers the level of care where we have somebody at the patient's bedside 24 hours a day until we get that patient comfortable again. Nighttime are nurses, so the nurse can administer medication, the family can get rest, and during the day is CNAs. So that's also 100% covered under Medicare. The next level of care beyond that is at it's called general inpatient care. And we do that at our Naperville inpatient unit, which is on Deal Road in 59.
Yes.
We built that, Seasons Hospice built that 5 years ago because we needed a place to bring our patients to a controlled setting when they were having some sort of a crisis. So it's a 14-bed private unit. It's beautiful.
I've heard good things
about it. We've had over 4,000 patients have moved through that unit in the past 5 years.
Wow.
It's a really beautiful place. And our medical director sees every patient every day, also 100% covered under Medicare. So, and the ambulance transport, from there to home is covered. So
that's also important to know.
Very important to know. People are always concerned about ambulance transports.
Right.
But once you're a patient and you transfer ambulance, then that's our bill. So,
okay.
We cover everything under that umbrella. So, patients can stay at the unit while their symptoms is managed. There are times when patients come to the unit and if things are moving in a negative direction, they may have end of life there. Some patients may choose to not want to be at home for end of life. So we will also honor that wish. If they're at home and it looks like things are moving in that direction, we'll transfer them to the unit. It's got a beautiful family room, family dining room, a children's room, and the entire team of people, which I'll mention really quick, that we offer wherever the patient's at. So there's a nurse first, which is an RN, a home health aide, which does all the things like nice baths and shave the patient and wash their hair. They'll do mani-pedis, light massage. Next is social work support. And social work is for, again, not just the patient, but the entire family. A lot of times the social worker will meet with the kids and the family and kind of meet them where they're at and explain what's happening, to mom or dad or grandma or grandpa. Sometimes people need help with paperwork or, anything that relates under the social worker umbrella. We have chaplain, which is non-denominational, but if some family members want a priest or a rabbi, we can absolutely arrange for that. Then we have music therapy, which is a beautiful thing. It's for the treatment of shortness of breath, pain, and agitation. Mm-hmm. When you breathe, when we hear music, when you turn the radio on, you automatically start to breathe to the rhythm of whatever song we hear. So when you take that concept into hospice, our music therapists are board certified in both hospice and music, and they'll start to play a song for the patient that they may like, certain kind of music or a certain song that may have special meaning. And when they see the patient's breathing match the rhythm of the music, then they slow the music down ever so slightly and their breathing will relax with it. And they keep doing that a little bit of time until the patient's completely relaxed. And it can be often as effective as medication for those three symptoms: shortness of breath, pain, and agitation. And plus, it's spiritually uplifting. Every time we hear music, it brings back good times and good memories. So that's right. Nice. And then we have our volunteers that are also available. We have art therapy for some patients that like to do that. So those are the team members. And then the last level of care, which is not always covered under a private insurance, but it is covered under Medicare and Medicaid, is respite, which is when a patient is at home and being taken care of by caregivers or family members, and they need a break, or they have, you know, a wedding to go to out of town. Medicare pays for up to 5 days at a time for a patient to come to our unit, and we take really good care of them while the family has a break.
And that's really a great service.
It's huge. It's
sorely needed in our area.
Yeah. And so people
don't really understand it either. So.
Right. It's something that obviously, again, speaks to the fact that the whole goal is to not have the patient coming back to the hospital anymore. And in order to do that, you not only have to provide excellent care for the patient, but for the family. There has to be a support system. And more, I think that's why palliative care and hospice and home care are being utilized so much more now, because the hospitals and the physicians are recognizing there has to be a good plan of care when the patient leaves the hospital. And if there's not a good plan, then they end up back in the ER again. And that's the last thing that we want. So we want to make sure that they receive that support on all levels. If you want more information on Seasons Hospice, you can call 1-800-570-8809, and they can get as much information as they like. If they want to consult, you don't even have to have an actual, just to have a conversation. You could have what we call an information session. You don't have to have an order for hospice. Maybe you just want somebody to come out and talk to you about it. So we do that all the time too. So
good. Uh-huh. Getting ahead of it. So yeah. That's really great. So thank you both for coming. I know that if you're looking for the advanced directives paperwork, you can go on Rush Copley website.
Actually, and mm-hmm. just put advanced directives in the search box, and you'll come back with both the current English and Spanish version of those advanced directives.
Right. And if you come see me at the senior center, that's where I'm going to go get it and absolutely. Print it out for you. So if you don't have a computer at home or a printer at home, then we can print those things for you here. So you can be all set, and you can give them to your physicians and make sure your agent knows that you've correct. Chosen them, all those fun things. So thank you, Dan. Thank you, Kathy, for coming out today. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.